We are in Job chapter 19, and I believe that we came as far as verse 22, Job from verse 13 down, just saying his brethren have forsaken him, his acquaintances, his kinfolk, his familiar friends, his maids, his servants, his wife, children, his most intimate friends whom he loves, they have all turned on him. His skin is cleaving to his bones. Have pity on me, verse 21, O ye my friends, for the hand of God hath touched me. Why do you persecute me as God and are not satisfied with my flesh? You see my physical illness. Why do you feel like you need to add to that? And I think probably they're in some ways one of the lowest points in the book, because no doubt there is whatever struggle that each of us would have within if all of our children were taken away. All the, you know, the tremendous things that Job is suffering, trying to reconcile that with God's love. Lord, if you love me and I've walked with you, I've bragged about you to other people, I've, you know, share the good news of Christ, and hear all of my children, 10 of them die in a day, and my wife is bitter, telling me to curse you and die. My health now is gone. And now, you know, it's almost like you have to reconcile somehow within yourself. You have to find some place you never had to search for before to come to terms with those things and God's faithfulness. And then on top of that, the physical illness, which wears you out. He says he doesn't sleep. He, you know, the day gets dark too soon, and then the light comes before he sleeps at night. He must be in so much pain that he tosses and turns. He can't sleep. And then you imagine on top of that your three closest friends standing around you telling you that the problem is you, that you're a sinner. Just, he says, my most intimate friends that I loved have forsaken me, have stabbed me in the back. So again, you know, that's a whole different level of pain. I don't know how many of you have gone through some betrayal. That can be as agonizing as any physical pain, when someone close has violated and betrayed you. And lifelong scars can come from that kind of thing. And Job is in the depths of despair. And this is one of the places where the light shines the brightest. All of a sudden, this light begins to shine through in regards to, in his darkest moment, in regards to the Redeemer. Oh, that my words were now written, he says in verse 23. Oh, that they were printed in a book. Of course, he didn't know about the book of Job. That they were graven with an iron pen, that the idea is a chisel, and lead in the rock forever. That someone would chisel my words in a rock and then fill the engraving with lead. It would last even longer. Because the light that's breaking on him, he said, I just wish this part of my suffering was recorded. I wish that it was put down for future generations. For I know that my Redeemer lives. And it's in the emphatic, I, you know, what he's saying, me, can you, of all people, God has shown this to me, I, such a one as me, suffering, that seems so forsaken of God, I know that my Redeemer lives. Now, the word Redeemer, interestingly, is not used in the New Testament. You won't find the word Redeemer in the New Testament. You will find the word redemption in the New Testament. In Luke 21, Jesus says, when you see these things begin to take place, lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. When you see these things begin to come to pass, the things that we're seeing on the news today in Luke's gospel, speaking to you and I here this evening, telling of the signs of the times, the end of the world, nations, perplexity of nations, meaning no way out, men looking at things that are coming on the world, their hearts failing them for fear, nation against nation, kingdom against kingdom. We're seeing these things. When they begin to take place, he says, lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. And then a few verses after that, he says, and this must be to another group of people, when these things come to pass, when they come to completion, then know the kingdom of God is at hand, the millennium. So it's very interesting the way he divides there. When they begin to take place, there's a group of people that should look up because their redemption has drawn nigh. And that word is used 5 times in the New Testament, and you can find it on your own. But everywhere else it's used in regards to the redemption of the physical body. I think he's talking about the rapture. The completion, you know, of our salvation, the redemption. When they begin to take place, look up, for your redemption draws nigh. When they come to completion, then know the kingdom of God is at hand, the millennium. So we are at the phase presently of looking up, for our redemption is drawn nigh. Now, there's a lot of wrestling over this. I know that my Redeemer lives. Some go to a great extent to say he's talking about the Goel, the kinsman Redeemer. But this is pre-law. The kinsman Redeemer in Israel, if you were killed, your brother or the closest male relative would then have a responsibility to pursue the person that killed you and to hunt them down and kill them, unless they had fled to a city of refuge. And if it was involuntary manslaughter, they were then safe to live in the city of refuge until the high priest died, and then they were free. If someone was in a business dealing with you and you found yourself in debt to that person, and then that person took you as a servant, the kinsman redeemer could come and redeem you, pay the price of redemption to buy your freedom. Or if your land was taken, this is under the law, this is many years after this, the kinsman redeemer could come and pay the price of the land to redeem it. But this is long before any of that takes place. And Job begins to talk about a redeemer who will stand on the earth in the latter day. And I think Job is having a remarkable vision of Jesus Christ here, obviously. In James chapter 5, James says this, "Take, my brethren, the prophets." The idea is for an example. "Take the prophets who have spoken in the name of the Lord for an example of suffering, affliction, and of patience. Behold, we count them happy who endure. You have heard of the patience of Job, and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful and tender in mercy." You saw the end of the story. But he puts Job amongst the prophets there. We're told in Revelation 19, verse 10, that the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. The very inspiration behind prophecy is the testimony of the Messiah, Jesus. So, no doubt, Job here, prophetically, lifting his head above the clouds, like Isaiah did in Isaiah 53, like David did in Psalm 22, like Enoch did when he saw the Lord coming with 10,000 of his saints. Job here lifting his head, God being so gracious to him at the deepest and darkest hour in his life, God takes Job and he lifts up his head like those that will lift up their head when the redemption draws nigh. He lifts up Job's head and Job says, "Oh man, if I try to tell you what God has shown me, I wish that my words were written. I wish they were carved in a rock forever. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself, mine eyes shall behold, and not another, though my reins be consumed within me, though my desires consume." Job is saying that he believes the day is coming when his Redeemer will stand on the earth, and though it will be after his body has deteriorated in the ground, that he will see God in his body with his own eyes for himself. And it is remarkable and pitiful to me to see scholarship rip this apart. And then you ask, you know, well, but then they say, well, but it could, that could be an accurate translation just to believe what it says. How about that? And then they say, and if Job did see the Redeemer and was trying to say that he believed in resurrection, that, in fact, those would be the words that he would use. How about that? And for thousands of years, every generation of believers has taken the meaning of these verses to mean what they say without scholars helping them. And more than that, when the Redeemer comes and stands on the earth, and Job rises and sees him, that'll be what it means too. So I don't have any problem with this meaning exactly what it says. Job tells us several things here. One is that the Old Testament saints are going to be raised when Christ touches down, not before that. The church is raised before that, caught up to meet the Lord in the air. When the Redeemer comes and stands on the earth, it says, then Old Testament saints who died in faith will be raised. And it is my own conviction, you can have your own, that Christ doesn't raise them the moment he touches down, because when you read Daniel, there's an extra 75 days out of there. I believe that Christ rebuilds the temple, that Christ begins to renew the earth, that he begins to set things in order, and that when the Old Testament saints are raised, they're raised to behold the kingdom, not the desolation that's in the earth after the tribulation. So it tells us that. The second coming of Christ, certainly a central teaching. It is something that is neglected in the church today, and what calls itself the church. Jesus said to the Pharisees, "You hypocrites, you can discern the signs of the sky, but you can't discern the signs of the time. You say, red sky in morning, sailor take warning, red sky at night, sailor's delight, you know that. And you can discern the signs of the weather, but you can't discern the signs of the times," and reprove them for that. Jesus, in Luke 19, about to ride into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, is weeping, convulsing, and says, "If you had only known the things that belong to this thy day, the things of thy peace, but now, behold, the city will be desolated, your children shall be destroyed within thee," and so forth. He held them accountable to know the prophecies of Daniel and where they were in the prophetic scenario. And certainly the scripture holds us responsible to see the signs of the times. And we have entered into the times of the signs now, not just the signs of the times. When the Bible talks about the signs of the times are long, immeasurable epochs of time that are just not particularly measured. They're long periods of time. But the signs of the times are what mark an end to those epochs of time. And Jesus says there would be signs. And we're seeing them today. The rapture could happen tonight. There's nothing forbidding that. It could happen 50 years from now. The rapture could happen right as the 70th week of Daniel begins, the seven-year tribulation. Or the rapture could happen 30 years before the tribulation begins. But there is enough evidence today for everyone in this room to look at the news and say, "Lord, how do my priorities need to be different? What really is important? Look at what's happening in the world. Lord, I want to be ready when you come. I want to be found busy about your business. I know that my Redeemer lives and that he's coming." Central part of our faith. 260 chapters in the New Testament, 216 of them mention the second coming of Jesus Christ. 27 books in the New Testament, 23 of them talk about the second coming of Christ. All 9 human authors that the Holy Spirit used to write through mention the second coming of Christ. Paul mentions the second coming of Christ 50 times in 13 epistles, by far the largest subject of the New Testament. the second coming of Jesus Christ. You know, and it's just, you know, when I, you know, travel and leave home, I was in Jerusalem when President Reagan decided to bomb Libya. And that's always exciting because, you know, you can't swim home. You just feel very far from home, you know. Kath called and woke me up in the middle of the night and said, I just thought you'd like to know, we just bombed Libya. And I'm looking around the hotel, who's we and what's Libya? And, you know, what? And it takes you a while to get your bearings. And, you know, the next day the Israelis, oh, you're an American, tell President Reagan. We said, thank you, somebody's doing something. He said, like, they expected I was going to write back and see him when I got home. But you feel very far from home. Or last year on the West Coast, September 11th, I was in California and when all of that happened. And again, you're looking at it thinking, okay, is this going to proliferate? How far is this going to go? What's going to happen here? And you feel very far from home. And if I knew that I was going to be separated from my children over a prolonged period of time, and their heart was going to be broken, but I knew that I was going to come again, and that we were going to be reunited, and that all of their sorrow and all of their pain would be removed, and that all of the waiting would be worthwhile, I would remind them of that many times, because I love them. It would be a constant part of my conversation with them. And that is why I believe it is by far the broadest subject of the New Testament, because I think by far it is the most urgent doctrine on the heart of Jesus Christ as he waits to come for his bride. I mean, you know, any groom is waiting for that bride, waiting to carry her over the threshold. I know that my Redeemer lives. What a remarkable passage. He shall stand the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself. My eyes shall behold and not another, though my reins be consumed within me. But, back to his friends, you should say, why persecute we him, seeing the root of the matter is found in me? You know, the idea is we're just as mortal as he is. Why are we picking on him? Be ye afraid of the sword. Anything could happen to you too. For wrath bringeth the punishments of the sword, that you may know there is judgment. Who knows what's going to come on your head? You're no better than I am. Then answered Zophar. And this is the last time we have to listen to Zophar. No, there's one more Zophar. Well, maybe one more Bildad, no more Zophars. But this is the end of the second triad, the second group of three confrontations from these friends. Then answered Zophar, the Namathite, said, therefore do my thoughts cause me to answer, and for this I make haste. Job, you're getting me angry. I know my Redeemer lives. Why would God show that to a sinner like you? I have heard the check of my reproach, and the spirit of my understanding causeth me to answer. Quite a philosopher here. Knowest thou not this of old, since man was placed upon the earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the hypocrite is but for a moment? You wicked hypocrite. Thanks, buddy. You know, these are highs and lows. One minute God lifts your heart up and shows you the most remarkable scene, and next thing, Zophar's talking to you. Oh, I'm sure you have a Zophar in your life, too. Though his excellency, the wicked, the hypocrite, though his excellency, his pride, his, you know, whatever he rises up to be in life, mount up to heavens, and his head reach unto the clouds, yet he shall perish forever like his own dung. That helps, Zoph. Thanks. What a terrible thing to say. He shall perish like his own dung. They which have seen him shall say, where is he? He shall fly away as a dream and shall not be found. Yea, he shall be chased away as the vision of the night. The eye also which saw him shall see him no more, neither shall his place any more behold him. His children shall seek to please the poor, and his hand shall restore their goods. He's going to begin to say that his family then will try to make amends with the poor, because now Zophar and Eliphaz are going to start to accuse Job of forsaking the poor, not caring. You know, they come to some conclusion that, you know, that God deals with those who misuse the orphan and the widow, and he does. And he will deal with anyone who misuses the less fortunate. But Job in chapter 29 will say, young men saw me and hid themselves. The aged arose and stood out of respect, contrary to culture. Princes refrained their talking, laid their hand upon their mouth. The nobles held their peace, and their tongue clave to their mouth. When the ear heard me, it blessed me. And when the eye saw me, it gave witness to me, because I delivered the poor that cried, and the fatherless, and him that had none to help him. The blessing of him that was ready to perish came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My judgment was as a robe and a diadem. I was eyes to the blind, and I was feet to the lame. I was a father to the poor, and the cause which I knew not I searched out, and I brake the jaws of the wicked, and I plucked the spoil from their teeth. You know, he goes on saying that, in fact, he had very much taken up for the part of the less fortunate. Well, here's Zophar's accusation. Your children are going to seek to make amends to the poor for the things that you've done to restore their goods. His bones, the wicked, are full of sin, the sin of his youth, which shall lie down with him in the dust. I'm so thankful that the sin of my youth is gone and God doesn't remember it and is not going to lie down with me anywhere. Though wickedness be sweet in his mouth, though he hide it under his tongue, though he spare it and forsake it not, but keep it still within his mouth, yet his meat in his bowels is turned. It is the gall of asps within him. His wickedness will turn to poison. He hath swallowed down riches. He shall vomit them up again. God shall cast them out of his belly. I'm sure Job feels like listening to this as he's being eaten with worms. And he shall suck the poison of asp, and viper's tongue shall slay him. He shall not see the rivers of floods and the brooks of honey and butter. When the Bible talks about the land that flows with milk and honey, the idea is it flows with milk because it was good for pasture, for flocks. It flows with honey because it was good for pollination, for orchards, with bees. Yeah, so a land that flowed with milk and honey was a land that was rich for pasturing animals, for pollination, for raising vineyards and so forth. He shall not see the rivers, the floods, the brooks of honey and butter. That which he labored for shall he restore. He shall not swallow it down. According to his substance shall the restitution be, and he shall not rejoice therein, because he hath oppressed and forsaken the poor, because he hath violently taken away a house which he builded not. These are heavy accusations. Surely he shall not feel quietness in his belly. Isn't that interesting? We call that agita today. He shall not feel quietness in his belly. Human beings, you know, are very complicated, integrated systems, physical, emotional, spiritual. The question is, often when we see someone breaking down, are they breaking down because there's a chemical imbalance, or is there a chemical imbalance because they're breaking down? Is it the chicken or is it the egg? Is it stress that they've internalized that is freaking out their system, producing acid, making ulcers, you know, causing things to be out of balance? Or is the things that are out of balance making them stress out? Isn't it interesting to hear him say this? Surely he shall not feel quietness in his belly. He shall not save that which he desires. There shall none of his food be left. Therefore shall no man look for his goods. In the fullness of his sufficiency he shall be in straits. Every hand of the wicked shall come upon him. When he is about to fill his belly, God shall cast the fury of his wrath upon him, and shall rain it upon him while he is eating. Man, oh man, Zophar, take a hike. He shall flee from the iron weapon. This guy's really been reading Shakespeare or something. and the bow of steel shall strike him through. It is drawn, it comes out of the body, goes in one side, it's coming out the other. Yea, the glittering sword comes out of his gall, comes out of his guts, and the terrors are upon him. Job must be thinking, what are you talking about? I'm down and out, I'm miserable. How about some encouragement? What in the world? What have you been watching, the X-Files? What is your problem? All darkness shall be hid in his secret places. A fire not blown, you know, without bellows, shall consume him. It shall go ill with him that is left in his tabernacle. The heaven shall reveal his iniquity. The earth shall rise up against him. The increase of his house shall depart, and his goods shall flow away in the day of his wrath. This is the portion of the wicked man from God, and the heritage appointed unto him by God. Job, this is your destiny, buddy. Get used to it. Satan's just using Zophar to continue to torment Job, to try to get him to break down, to prove to God that he was right about Job's inability to stand up under pressure. Man, oh man. But Job answered and said, Job's great. Hear diligently my speech. Listen closely. And let this be your consolations. Suffer me. Just be quiet for a little bit that I may speak, and then after I have spoken, mock on. No surprises here. Just shut up for a minute, let me talk, and then you can just go spouting off your nonsense again. As for me, is my complaint to man? You know, I'm not arguing with you guys. And if it were so, why should my spirit be troubled? If it was an argument between men, that wouldn't be the problem. Take notice of, mark me and be astonished. Lay your hand upon your mouth, because I'm going to say something now that will shock you. Even when I remember, I am afraid and trembling. It takes hold of my flesh. Wherefore do the wicked live and become whole old, and yea, are mighty in power? You see, their whole argument is, Job, the wicked suffer, the righteous prosper. You're in this big mess because you're wicked. And the more we think about it, you must have been mean to orphans and widows and done all this stuff. And, you know, you're going to get shot with the arrow, and this is going to stick through you, and you're going to die, and the worms are going to eat you. You know, just, you know, shut up for a minute. I'll talk, then you guys can continue to mock on. Job says, my argument is not with men. It's with God that I'm troubled. Because your philosophy is for the birds. And he begins to dismantle their argument again, their philosophy, their theology. He says, why do the wicked live and become old? They don't all die. Some of them flourish. Job says the problem is, well, Psalm 73 again, that there's often the righteous suffer and the wicked flourish. Wherefore do the wicked live? They become old. They are mighty in power. Their seed is established in their sight with them, their offspring before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear. Neither is the rod of God upon them. Now, that's a partial truth. Often in this world, God's rod doesn't come, but ultimately God keeps very good books, and there will be the day of recompense. Their bull gendereth and faileth not, reproducing. Their cow calveth and casteth not her calf. There's no stillborn or premature births. They send forth their little ones like a flock, and their children dance. They take the timbrel and the harp and rejoice at the sound of the organ. They spend their days in wealth, and in a moment go down to the grave. Job, what he's saying is, you know, why is it that my argument's not with you, my argument's with God, because this seems unjust. You know, here I am a righteous man, and I haven't turned away from God. I've walked in his ways. And here I am, and my last days are going to be spent eaten of worms, suffering, eaten up of a fever, living with a broken heart and friends that have forsaken me. And how is it that the wicked so often go on? They live their whole life, they flourish, and then the day of their death comes and they die without spending all that time suffering. They live, they die, and they're gone in a moment. Therefore they say unto God, depart from us. We desire not the knowledge of thy ways. You know, we're happy without God. What do we need God for? You know what it's like trying to share the Lord with somebody that has everything they think they need, that's prospering, that's healthy. They're in that time in their life when nothing's going wrong. They're getting over on all their business deals. They're ripping people off. They're flourishing. Things going great for them. And they look at you. You're a Christian and you have cancer. You're telling me about the love of God? No, thanks. I'll just, what do I need him for? Look at my life and look at your life. And he says there are the philosophies of the wicked that speak about God in that way. What is the Almighty, verse 15, that we should serve him? And what profit should we have if we were to pray to him? You know, Job said, you've heard these things. Lo, their good is not in their hand. This is a very profound statement. Their good, their future, their flourishing, their benefit. They think it is, but it is not in their own hand. The grammar, colon, semicolon there in English, lo, their good is not in their hand. The idea is so, because of that, the counsel of the wicked is far from me. I know that all of that is not within their own hand. And they're not flourishing because of something they've done. So their counsel doesn't matter to me. It's far from me. How often is the candle of the wicked put out? Now, how often is that? That we see somebody really sinful, really wicked, somebody that really irks us, somebody that's really getting away with murder, somebody that really just bothers us. Our stomach has no quietness when we see this person in the media or wherever. How often do we see a person like that struck down? It's not that often. In the eternity. How often is the candle of the wicked put out? How often cometh their destruction upon them? God distributeth sorrows in his anger. He distributes. They are as stubble before the wind, and as chaff that the storm carrieth away. God layeth up his iniquity for his children. God is noticing. He rewardeth them, and he shall know it. His eyes shall see his destruction. It will come, and he shall drink of the wrath of the Almighty. For what pleasure hath he in his house after him, when the number of his months is cut off in the midst? That's when he'll begin to realize the folly of his wickedness. Shall any teach God knowledge? Interesting question. Shall any teach God knowledge? There are those in the church that embrace an idea that we have to inform God of certain things. Paul Yonggi Cho, in his book The Fourth Dimension, talks about praying for a bicycle, for a long time, and his prayer wasn't answered, finally saying to God one day, Lord, why didn't you answer my prayer? And he said, the Lord said to him, because you didn't say what kind of bike you wanted. Shall any teach God knowledge? So then he told God what kind of bike he wanted. Prayed for a while again, it still didn't come. He said, God, I told you what kind of bike I wanted. Why didn't you give me the bike? And he said, God said, you didn't tell me what color you wanted. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm not looking for a God who doesn't know what kind of bike I want and what color it is. I'm looking for a God who already knows that, to tell you the truth. Jesus said his Father knows what things we have need of before we ask. So that's the God I'm looking for. The one David says, he knows our thoughts before any of them are formed. But shall any teach God knowledge, seeing he judges those that are on high? One dieth in his full strength, being wholly at ease and quiet. Never sick a day in his life, and he dropped over. His breasts are full of milk. Now, of course, he's talking about a man. It's just an expression poetically that speaks of vibrancy and health. And his bones are moistened with marrow. And another dieth in the bitterness of his soul. Never eats with pleasure. Never has a quiet day. Sick his entire life. Always struggling. And so your formulas don't hold up. They shall lie down alike in the dust, and the worms shall cover them. You know, there's a lot in Job about the worms. I mean, it's just strange as we go through. Behold, I know your thoughts. He's looking at Zophar and his friends. He said, I know what you're thinking, and the devices which you wrongfully imagine against me. For you say, where is the house of the prince, of this prince? This guy had a great hacienda. Where's the house of this guy? And where are the dwelling places of the wicked? You're thinking that my loss is evidence of the fact that I'm a sinner. Have ye not asked them that go by the way? Now he says, have you ever talked to the great merchants of the earth, is the idea. Do you know, King James says they're tokens. Have you ever heard the accounts, you know, of Marco Polo, of the tradesmen, of people who travel, that the wicked is reserved to the day of destruction. They shall be brought forth to the day of wrath. Who shall declare his way to his face? You know, have you ever talked to those guys that travel the high seas and the ships are taken over by pirates and the pirates get off with all the loot and innocent people get killed or caravans get raided? Have you ever talked? But the time of the wicked will come, you know, but who shall declare his way to his face? And nobody confronts them sometimes to their face. Who shall repay him for what he's done? Yet shall he be brought to the grave and shall remain in the tomb. And the clods of the valley shall be sweet unto him. This is poetry. Ah, yes, the clods of the valley shall be sweet. I never thought about that before. Every man shall draw after him as there are innumerable before him. You know, there's innumerable people, number of people that died before him that were like the sweet clods, and the line after him is coming up. How then comfort ye me in vain, seeing in your answers there remaineth falsehood? How are you trying to comfort me? But you guys, your theology is not, your whole philosophy is wrong. I mean, it's filled with falsehood. Then Eliphaz. Now this is the third triad. This is the last time we're going to hear from Eliphaz. Aren't you glad? And it takes about 10 years to go through the Bible, so hopefully the rapture will come before we hear from Eliphaz again. Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, can a man be profitable unto God as he that is wise may be profitable unto himself? Does a man really think that he can benefit God because his own wisdom has helped himself? Is it any pleasure to the Almighty that thou art righteous? Well, this is without the light we have of the New Testament, and certainly the Lord loves to see his Son being formed in us. But is it any pleasure to the Almighty that you're righteous, do you think, Job, claiming to be righteous? Or is it gain to him that you make your ways perfect, that you claim to be blameless? Will he reprove thee for fear of thee? Will he enter with thee in the judgment? Is God going to be afraid that he accuse you falsely and try to work this out with you? Is not thy wickedness great and thy iniquities infinite? These guys are not cutting them any slack. They're getting worse and worse. Is not thy wickedness great and thy iniquities infinite? Job, there's no end to your iniquities. Who wants to listen to this? I don't even want to listen to it, and I'm not getting eaten of worms. For thou hast taken a pledge from thy brother for nothing and stripped the naked of their clothing. Thou hast not given water to the weary to drink. Thou hast withholden bread from the hungry. And even in that culture, it was extolled, hospitality. Still, in some of that culture in the Middle East, is held in very high esteem. But as for the mighty man, he had the earth, and the honorable man dwelled in it. Thou hast sent widows away empty, and the arms of the fatherless have been broken. And this couldn't be further from the truth. Therefore, snares are round about thee, and sudden fears. Job, that's why everything's going wrong in your life. You were mean to orphans and widows. We finally figured it out. Or darkness that thou canst not see. It's come upon thee. It's why you don't understand. An abundance of waters cover thee. Is not God in the height of heaven? And behold the height of the stars, how high they are. That's an interesting question. And thou sayest, how doth God know? Can he judge through the dark cloud? You think God has trouble seeing down to earth on a cloudy day, Job? Thick clouds are a covering to him. He sees right through them. That he seeth not, is that what you think? And he walketh in the circuit of heaven. No, that's an interesting phrase. Over 2,000 years before Christ, the circuit of the heavens. The fact that the sun and the moon and the stars and the solar system are in a circuit is a very interesting concept for way before. We're going to hear in a few chapters when Job says he suspends the earth upon nothing. Because in the 1300s and in the 1500s, they drew the earth on the back of an elephant. And the elephant standing on a big tortoise. They never put anything under the tortoise. I don't know what's holding the tortoise up, but space elephant, space tortoise, holding up the earth there. That's an interesting. He walketh in the circuit of heaven. Hast thou marked the old way which wicked men have trodden, which were cut down out of time, whose foundation was overflown with a flood? Probably talking about the wickedness before Noah's flood. Which said unto God, depart from us. And what can the Almighty do for us? You know, the idea is, if this is the patriarchal age, the days of Abraham, the whole truth of the flood is very fresh. And the fact that God wiped out the entire earth because of the wickedness of man. So this idea would be very real in their minds, that God judges the wicked. He doesn't judge the righteous, he judges the wicked, because he spared Noah and his family, but he judged the wickedness of the earth. So, you know, that kind of thought would be very prevalent among them. But he says, you know, you've seen how the wicked were cut down out of time. Their foundation was overflown with a flood. Which said unto God, depart from us. And what can the Almighty do for them, for us? Yet he filled their houses with good things. But the counsel of the wicked is far from me now, Eliphaz says. The righteous see it. The idea is the wicked being cut down, and they are glad. And the innocent laugh them to scorn. Whereas our substance is not cut down, Job. Our kids are not dead, and our house is not burned up, and our substance is not cut down. But the remnant of them, the fire, consumeth. And some, a lot of his servants and cattle were burned up with fire. You know, he's saying, Job, he said, you know, the righteous hear this and understand, and they rejoice at the calamity of the wicked. You know, Job, if this isn't true, how will we ever convince anybody to follow God? If it isn't true that the wicked suffer and the righteous prosper, how could we ever get anybody to follow God? The righteous hear these things about the way God deals with the wicked, and they rejoice in those things. Now, in redemption, the Lord didn't come to fix this place. He came to buy us out of it, to rescue us. He's not going to fix it until he judges it and cleanses it with fire. The tree huggers are all going to have agita. Just says all of the green things are going to be burned up, and, you know, spotted owls will be gone. Everything's going to start over. He came to rescue us out of it. And he said in these days things would wax worse and worse. Acquaint now thyself with him. Job, you know, your problem is you need to get to know God and be at peace. Job knows God better than any of them, and he isn't at peace right at that moment. Thereby shall good come unto thee. Receive, I pray thee, the law from his mouth. Now, isn't this interesting? This is before the scripture, before the Old Testament is written, before Moses. How was it that they, and I don't know the answer, that they were receiving the law from his mouth, and lay up his words in thine heart? If thou return to the Almighty, thou shalt be built up. Thou shalt put away iniquity far from thy tabernacles. Then shalt thou lay up gold as dust, and the gold of Ophir as stones of the brooks. Now, this is a great motive to serve God. We have these health and wealth. This must be Kenneth Copeland writing this chapter here. What a motivation to serve God, so you can fill your house with gold dust. Then shalt thou lay up gold as dust, the gold of Ophir as the stones of the brooks. Yea, the Almighty shall be thy defense, and you'll have plenty of silver too. What a motivation. He's talking about Santa Claus, not God. He's got everything confused here. For then shalt thou have thy delight in the Almighty, and shalt lift up thy face unto God. You know, our delight in the Almighty is who He is and not what He does. David says, His gentleness hath made me great. You know, the great thing about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, when they're about to be thrown in the fire, they said, our God, whom we serve, can deliver us. We're not worried. We don't have to bow down to your statue, O King Nebi. He's able to deliver. And if not, we still aren't going to bow down. Because we worship our God because of who He is and not because of what He does. He's not the what He does God. He's the who He is God. He's the God that walked among us and took the children on His lap and blessed them. He's the God that fed the hungry multitudes and cleansed the lepers and raised the dead and sat with tax gatherers and sinners, walked on the sea, rebuked the wind. He's the God that left His place in glory, took on the fashion of man, and stretched out His hands on a wooden cross. Pay for our sins, to save us out of this world. And we delight in Him because of who He is. What He does is just a reflection of who He is. These guys say, hey, delight yourself in God. Gold, silver, you know, the bank account. Everything's hunky-dory with all of the Almighty, then the money starts to roll in. And thou shalt have delight in the Almighty. No, you won't have delight in the, you know, Job is going to have delight in the Almighty. It will be for a different reason. And shalt lift up thy face unto God. Thou shalt make thy prayer unto Him, and He shall hear thee. And thou shalt pay thy vows, because Job had complained that God wasn't listening. Thou shalt also decree a thing, and it shall be established unto thee. And the light shall shine upon thy ways. When men are cast down, then thou shalt say, there is lifting up, and He shall save the humble person. Job, you need to humble yourself. He shall deliver the island of the innocent. So don't worry about the guy on the island, okay? And it is delivered by the pureness of thine hands. I don't know. Job answered and said, even today is my complaint bitter. My groaning, my stroke is heavier than my groaning. Do you think that the things I've said are heavy complaints? You have no idea what I feel like inside. My complaint is not as heavy as the stroke that's come upon me. Oh, that I knew where I might find Him. You're telling me, oh, if you only seek God, everything will be hunky-dory. I wish I knew where I could find Him, that I might come even to His throne. I would order my cause before Him. The idea is not an argument, that He would reason. I would reason with Him and fill my mouth with arguments, with reasonings. I would know the words which He would answer me and understand. We just say, you think that I'm not looking for God? You think I don't care what God thinks? You think I'm not trying to find Him in all of my misery? He said, my complaint isn't half as heavy as the stroke that's fallen upon me, and I wish that I could find Him. And if I could find Him, I would long to reason with Him, and then I would listen to hear His answer, to hear what He might say to me. Will He plead against me, verse 6, with His great power? Is that what you guys think? That I'm like the wicked, He's going to slaughter me, that He's going to plead against me with His great power? No. but he would put strength in me. There the righteous might dispute. They might reason with him. So should I be delivered forever from my judge. You guys think he's judging me? No, he would strengthen me. I'd be delivered from my judge. Behold, I go forward, but he is not there, and backward, but I cannot perceive him. Ever feel this way? On the left hand, where he doth work, I see his work, but I cannot behold him. I can see his work, but I can't see him. He hideth himself on the right hand, and I cannot see him. Job says, you know where God is when you don't know where he is? He's right next to you, not wanting you to know where he is. That's where he is. That's what he says there. Job says, in the midst of the suffering, I look before me, and the language indicates to the east. I look behind me, backward, to the west, he's not there. I look to my left, to the north, he's not there. I can see his hand working, but I can't see him. I see his workings. I recognize his hand. I recognize his creation. I recognize his power, but I don't see him. And I look to the south, but I don't find him there. We reckon our points of the compass north, south, east, and west. The in the Middle East, they reckon it east, west, north, and south, because our word orientation, being oriented, we get that from facing east towards that's where the Orient gets its name, the east. Job says, I'm trying to get oriented. I'm just trying to find my bearings in all of this. I don't have the answers, but I know that your philosophy is wrong. I know God isn't judging me because I'm a sinner. He's going to say right down a few verses, I've esteemed his word more than my necessary bread. My foot has not turned away from his path. I know your philosophy and what you're telling me about God is wrong. God is not angry with me. God is not judging me. But I am having a hard time finding him in my suffering. And anybody in this church will tell you the same thing. It's difficult. I wish that I could sit face to face and talk with him. How often have we felt that way? And you know, if we could sit in my living room or sit in the park and just talk to him. If I could hear his voice answer me and help me understand. Because I know that he wouldn't rise up in his power to destroy me, but he would speak strength to me. I know that. Look east. Can't find him. Look behind me. He's not there. To the left, to the right. I see his hand around me. I see his working. I'm having trouble getting a hold of him. I'm trying to get my bearings in all of this suffering. I'm trying to reconcile what I know about God with my present situation. Trying to communicate to him, Lord, you've taken me somewhere I've never been before, and what I have known about you up until this time of suffering has been sufficient up until this time, but for the deep waters you've taken me into now, Lord, I need more. I need to hear from you. I see your hand around me. I can't find your face. I would love to hear your voice. I know you would strengthen me. Lord, help me. I'm trying to get my bearings in the midst of this sorrow. To me, you know, Job's faith has been evolving through these arguments. These men who have, you know, gotten on, I'll speak for myself, my nerves, Eliphaz, Zophar, Bildad, have in one sense been allowed by God, just like Satan was allowed to test Job, to be chisels, to chiseling away at Job's faith, refining, causing Job to argue and come to terms with truth and with error, with things he would probably rather not have thought about. And as the chapters are going on, as the process is going, we're watching Job's faith refined. And part of that is the chiseling away of Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar. And Job is coming to some very remarkable conclusions. Here and again, he lifts his head way above the clouds and he tells us something extremely remarkable about God in the midst of suffering.